Hello, and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and surrounding villages. This is the Red Saturn edition for the week ending Saturday the 25th of June 2022. Now, you are probably expecting to hear Bill's voice, backed by all his excellent music, but he's a bit under the weather at present, so you'll hear him next week in my place. But in this programme, we'll have our usual roundup of news stories from the current edition of the Hearts Advertiser, both in the paper and online versions. We'll also have our selection of interesting national radio programmes coming up in the next week, which, for a change, will be read by Rob. Then we'll have a selection of audio-described TV programmes for this coming week, and as usual, this is by courtesy of Otley Talking News. Then we have an item from TNF Soundings about the Order of St. John. And then we'll have the second airing of the third episode of the new series of the 10 Today exercise programme. And finally, we'll have this week's birthdays and events this week in the past. The music in this programme is called Rendezvous and is by Goffby. So, now the news. And our readers today are Deborah, Leslie, Wendy, and Gabby.
Hello, my name's Deborah, and my first piece is entitled Community Green Spaces at Risk of Development. A four-bedroomed home could be built on a slice of community green space controversially sold off to developers. Land on the Verulam estate was thought to be public space, until it was unexpectedly sold at auction after the original developer went into liquidation, even though a question mark hung over who actually owned the sites. Now plans have been revealed for a large residential home on a small area of green space where Westfields meets Windridge Close, which campaigners claim will be totally out of keeping with the smaller semi-detached and terraced properties in the vicinity. Verulam Residents Association says, if approved, the application would set a dangerous precedent for the rest of the estate. Chair Timothy Beecroft said, "We still have not heard if this application is going to be called in at a public meeting, at which councillors and residents can put forward their views. Given the significance of this application, in terms not just of its local impact, but its wider implications regarding the future of the green spaces on the Verulam estate, I think that many, most, or even all local residents would be absolutely outraged if this application was approved on the nod of an individual planning office. These green spaces have been maintained by the council since the estate was built, much enjoyed and used by the local community, and some of them, including the site under question, still bear council no ball game signs. The question of who owns and who is responsible for the management of the green spaces on the Verulam estate has, so far, been a shambles. It is now in danger of becoming a scandal." The Hearts ad revealed the extent of the Great Verulam Estate land sale back in June 2021, but this is the first application for development. The first lot of land sold included an area to the southwest of King Harry Lane, covering 15.26 acres, including highway, paths, verges, and what are described as parcels of land with development potential subject to planning. The land is situated in and around Main Avenue, Samian Gate, Flavian Close, Icknield Close, Glenham Close, Hadrian Close, Lindham Place, Augustus Close, Claudian Place, Antonine Gate, and Ermine Close. The second lot was 4.11 acres in and around Windridge Close, Westfields, Deaver Close, Dubray Close, Rowlett Drive, Main Avenue and Corinium Gate.
Hello, my name is Leslie And my first article is entitled, Could St Albans See a New City Council? Should a new local council be created for unrepresented parts of St Albans? As part of an ongoing review of community governance within the district, a natural consequence of rewarding brought about by the expansion of London Coney, St Albans District Council is considering establishing a new authority working on much more of a grassroots level. Wards it would cover include Clarence, Cunningham, Sopwell, St Peter's, Verulam, Hill End, Marshalswick West, Bernard's Heath and Batchwood. Although the unparished areas do presently enjoy dedicated representation through 24 councillors elected to the district council, there are presently no voices raised wholly on behalf of only St Albans. This contrasts with Harpenden, where the town council has developed into a mature and capable body able to provide worthwhile services to its residents and advocate on their behalf. Through the Levelling Up white paper, the government wants to make it easier for the local people and community groups to come together and set local priorities and shape their neighbourhood, which would be compatible with the creation of a local council. This would be funded by a precept paid by residents living within the designated area of the council, although an exact figure has yet to be established. Salisbury City Council has a comparable population to St Albans and raises some 3 million from its precept. Locally, councillors in Harpenden pay about £50 per annum more council tax than St Albans residents for their town council. Council leader Councillor Chris White explained, a new city council would make it more difficult for councillors not from St Albans to interfere in local matters, for example, pedestrianisation, although the downside would be it only works if you put up council tax. The most important thing is creating the right method of governance for unparished areas rather than specific structures. An alternative would be to give existing City Neighbourhoods Committee more power, such as a greater say over the management of assets principally used by St Albans City residents. Any decision on the new council structure will have to be made by the autumn and implemented in time for the council elections next May.
Hello, this is Wendy, and my first story is, what next for residents of Telford Court? No residents of Telford Court will have to move out of the district if the high-rise is demolished, St Albans Council has promised. There are 45 tenanted properties in the tower block and 15 in the surrounding masonettes, plus a further 8 leasehold properties across the site. Should St Albans District Council's Housing and Inclusion Committee decide to decommission the building, it would be emptied by March 2024. Residents will be invited to bid for new homes elsewhere in the district as soon as final decision is made. One of the available options is for tenants to move to the new development at CCOS South, which will include 93 flats, including 33 for social rent, and new commercial floor space on the former police station and NHS site in Victoria Street. In a statement to the Hearts Advertiser, a St Albans District Council spokesperson confirmed, no residents will have to move out of the district. Residents can take their personal circumstances into account when considering which new home to bid on. Approximately £734,000 has recently been spent on specialist surveys, new fire-rated doors, fire alarms, fire-retardant paint, and other measures as the council still has an ongoing duty of care to residents. Should demolition be agreed, the costs of decommissioning individual flats as they become empty, including relocation allowances and the purchase of leasehold properties, will add up to a total bill of around £4 million. Initial findings suggest remedial works to bring the building up to safety requirements would be so extensive and costly that they are not viable. The building would have to be stripped back to its bare shell, meaning all residents would have to move out and be rehomed in order that a full refit could take place. St Albans District Council and leaseholders, who would carry part of the cost, would then be left with a building with an outdated design and limited life. But should the decision be taken to replace Telford Court, new housing would be built in its place following further consultation.
Hello, my name is Gabby, and my first article is about life in the Tower Block. Weeks after learning about council plans to bulldoze the city's only tower block, residents of Telford Court are slowly coming to terms with the reality of the situation. Some now face the heart-wrenching prospect of leaving their homes of 50 years, while others are excitedly seizing the opportunity for a new start elsewhere. Whatever their individual situation, they are united by the realisation that demolition is almost a certainty, and their days living in the high-rise are numbered. We spoke to one resident about the experiences of her family during the time they have been living in the building, the unanswered questions surrounding the current consultation, and what her hopes are for the future. Diana, not her real name, said the communication they received about the building's proposed demolition and relocation of residents came as a complete shock to everyone. Both came extremely out of the blue about a year ago. We all had new front doors, new fire alarms drilled in, new communal doors, new balconies fitted, new CCTV throughout communal areas, and all communal areas repainted, all of which have been needed for many years. So why waste the money on making it safe now when it has been decided to be demolished? Following this initial letter here, there has been no further formal communication on the proposals. All the council workers are so relaxed and have initially filled us all with hope, saying, "You can have whatever you want," and "All will be fine," which is not only very misleading, but also a waste of time, as they can't actually tell us anything. We have heard through other sources now that there are three possible areas that are being allocated for Telford Court residents: the King Offer, the police station, and Batchwood, where they have built social housing within the last year. If this is the plan, then we should be told. The money that all residents are receiving to relocate comes from a government fund that we are entitled to and is not council money, but we have been made to feel that we should be grateful for it. This money will be used for moving and decorating whatever property we move into, as older style council homes will need a lot of money and time to bring them up to a livable standard. Her own experiences of living in Telford Court reads like a shopping list of social housing woes, from unexplained leaks and mushrooms growing on walls to exposed asbestos and a bathroom rendered unusable for days after the ceiling collapsed, forcing the family to use a temporary toilet in a communal flat down an alley. We have asked, as we are moving out anyway within the next 12 to 18 months, can they not find us a new home sooner so we can be safer? As you can imagine, by this point we really have had enough, as we think everything we are saying has a valid point and is probably happening to most people within this block, and we want out. Diana added, "Telford Court has had a bad name for a number of years due to drug use, deaths and antisocial behaviour. Nothing proactively has ever been done to ensure anyone's safety within this block. The awful tragedy of Shumin Hussein is infamous, but still to this day the windows open inwards fully, all the way up to the 11th floor. I would have thought that would have been a high priority given the nature of what happened here. My questions to our landlord, St Albans District Council, are: the social housing situation is already full stretch, so how are you planning on housing us? Why have we been left for so long with exposure to asbestos? Why, when reporting vandalism or theft or any crime, is nothing done? Why are we paying a service charge when our local neighbour does all our gardens for us? When am I personally going to be moved into permanent, safer living conditions?
Hearts ATM users should phone 101 if cards are swallowed amid spate of fraud. A spate of cash point fraud is thought to have taken place throughout Hertfordshire. Police officers in the county are warning residents to be vigilant if they use ATMs in the county. Several thefts are reported to have taken place as a result of tampering. On one occasion, a victim was guarding the ATM she was using while on the phone to the bank, according to social media reports. Cash was taken from her account at an ATM elsewhere while the card was still in the machine. Detective Sergeant Mark Favour of Hertfordshire Constabulary said, "It appears that these thefts are being achieved by a discreet device being placed over the card slot of the machine, which scans the card details, transmits the data to the criminal, and then blocks the card from being returned. The best way to avoid this happening to you is to cancel or suspend your bank card if it is retained by an ATM. If you have a banking app on your phone, you may be able to freeze your card temporarily until you can establish what has happened. Alternatively, you may need to call your bank to cancel or suspend the card until it has been recovered." A police spokesperson said ATM users should shield their PINs and examine the machines before they take cash out. If the machine looks like it has been tampered with, ATM users should phone their bank. If the machine swallows the card or does not return cash, ATM users are being asked to phone the police's non-emergency line on 101.
My next article is the weekly column from St Albans MP Daisy Cooper and is entitled "Stress and Misery Caused by Passport Delays." After years of COVID travel restrictions, lots of people have booked trips abroad this summer. Normally, this would be a time of happy anticipation, but backlogs in the passport office have made many people anxious that their trips abroad may not happen at all. Despite people applying for passports or renewals well ahead of their departure dates, many people simply haven't received their passports. Since January, scores of local residents have contacted me and asked for help, many after experiencing delays of more than the maximum 10-week wait period. One resident had been waiting an incredible 13 weeks for her passport, so I raised the case in a parliamentary debate. My constituent needed to know, that day, whether to cancel her travel plans or wait for the passport and potentially lose thousands of pounds if it didn't arrive in time. She decided to take a chance, and 4 days after I first raised it, and the day before she travelled, she finally received her passport. In another case, a carer had waited weeks for their passport, only to find themselves physically standing outside the passport office for the whole day before their day of departure. Despite my team's best efforts, unfortunately, the systems in the passport office had completely broken down. So I therefore attended the MP Passport Hub and refused to leave until my constituent had their passport in their hand. 2 hours later in the evening, with some passport office officials being asked to return to the office to print the secure forms, it was resolved. Other MPs have raised cases of people whose jobs depended on getting their passports, including a seafarer. The government has had 2 years to prepare for this uptick in passport applications and even changed the standing waiting period from 6 to 10 weeks to give itself more time to process them. But it's clear that the government was still woefully underprepared. After all this chaos, opposition parties called on the government to apologise to those who have been affected by the delays, but the government used its majority to reject these calls in a vote. This passport shambles is adding extra stress and misery to many people's lives. At the very least, they should have received an apology.
Major improvements announced for district cemeteries. Cemeteries across the district are set to undergo major improvements as part of a detailed plan approved by councillors. The three cemeteries run by St Albans District Council are Hatfield Road and London Road in St Albans and Harpenden's Westfield Road. The first of these includes the grave of former mayor and golf competition founder Samuel Ryder and a selection of Commonwealth war graves. Proposals include enhancing gardens of rest, better monitoring of the upkeep of new graves, and action to reduce litter. A report on the cemeteries was given to a meeting of St Albans District Council's Public Realm Committee, where a detailed plan was agreed to improve the cemeteries and to implement that plan over the next year. This will be developed in consultation with faith, bereavement and community groups, including those involved with heritage and the environment. Committee Chair Councillor Helen Campbell said, "Cemeteries are one of the most important services that we provide our community. They are not only places for burials, but also places where people go to find peace and solace, to pay their respects and to reconnect with their past. I am delighted that the committee has approved a cemeteries improvement plan that will ensure we achieve the highest possible standards in all areas, provided we identify sources of funding. The plan sets out ways for improving our grounds maintenance, land management, building maintenance, customer service and engagement with the community. We will be consulting intensively with all interested groups in the months ahead to ensure the plans respond to the needs of all our communities." The committee also agreed a proposal for a small-scale mausoleum at London Road Cemetery could be provided if there was shown to be demand. This would be an alternative to a previous project to create a large mausoleum with 200 spaces after a feasibility study revealed similar buildings elsewhere have not been a particularly popular option for those who have lost a loved one. The Institute of Cemetery and Crematorium Management recommended the revised approach. It concluded that the best way forward was to concentrate on other areas such as investment in the gardens of rest. Its recommendations form the basis of the improvement plan. Councillor Campbell added, "In setting out our plans, we have subjected previous proposals to a thorough re-examination and taken aboard the advice of the Institute. This has been a rigorous exercise and we will continue with that approach to deliver the improvements."
My second article is entitled "Doctors Save Woman's Life After She Collapses During Park Run." Two off-duty doctors taking part in a St Albans park run used their professional skills to bring another runner back from the brink of death. Joanna Aspel and Anne Krishnanandan were among 200 competitors taking part in a race at Jersey Farm Woodland Park, Sandridge, on the morning of July 24th last year. Only a few kilometres into the race, a woman running in front of them collapsed, and the two doctors from Luton and Dunstable Hospital immediately went to her aid. They found that although the woman, later identified as Toby Abati, was breathing, she was unresponsive. After calling for an ambulance, they found that her breathing was worse, and were unable to find a pulse. they began administering cardiac pulmonary resuscitation, CPR, while another runner, using Dr. Krishnanandan's phone, kept the ambulance service updated on the situation. A defibrillator was then brought to the scene, and they used that to shock Miss Abati and then continued with the CPR until the ambulance arrived. An air ambulance was called, and the woman was airlifted to hospital, where she went on to recover from her ordeal. Now Drs. Aspel and Krishnanandan have both been awarded Royal Humane Society resuscitation certificates for saving her life. Praising them for their action, Andrew Chapman, Secretary of the Society, said, "Put simply, they were the right people in the right place at the right time. They knew exactly what to do and wasted no time in starting their fight to save their fellow runner. They did a magnificent job and were true life-saving heroes. They richly deserve the awards they are to receive." At the same time, this is yet another case which emphasises the need for not most members of the emergency services, but as many people as possible, to learn how to administer CPR. It can, as it did in this case, save lives. The roots of the Royal Humane Society stretch back more than two centuries. It is the premier national body for honouring bravery in the saving of human life. Since it was set up, the Society has considered over 87,000 cases and made over 200,000 awards.
In digital colour, see the Book of St. Albans in all its glory. Seminal 13th century masterpiece, The Book of St. Albans, has been digitised for the first time. One of the most finely illustrated medieval manuscripts, Benedictine monk Matthew Paris's renowned work, features 54 individual works of art and has fascinated readers across the centuries, from royalty to Renaissance scholars. The precious manuscript survived the chaos and trauma of the dissolution of the monasteries and came to Trinity College Dublin in 1661. The manuscript chronicles the life of St. Alban and outlines the construction of St. Alban's Abbey, which was one of the most important pilgrimage destinations in the country. The book was held in the abbey for 300 years, until the dissolution in 1539. The Book of St. Albans was a high-status book, viewed by King Henry VI. Written in Latin, it also contains Anglo-Norman French, which made it accessible to a wider secular audience, including educated noble women. It was borrowed by noble ladies of the period, including the king's sister-in-law, Countess Cornwall, Sanchia of Provence, and others. The content includes illustrations featuring the decapitation of St. Alban and his executioner, whose eyes literally pop out of his head at the point of execution. The artwork, consisting of mostly framed narrative scenes, is a tinted drawing technique where outlined drawings are highlighted with coloured washes from a limited palette. This technique was distinctly English, dating back to Anglo-Saxon art of the 10th century. From St. Alban's Abbey, it came into the ownership of the Elizabethan royal adviser and astronomer John Dee, following which it was sold to James Usher, Archbishop of Armagh, and subsequently came to Trinity with his library in 1661. It has remained in the library of Trinity College, Dublin, for over 350 years. For the first time, this manuscript is now fully digitised and available online, a process which has been undertaken through the Virtual Trinity Library Initiative, as part of its Manuscripts for Medieval Studies project, funded by Carnegie Corporation of New York. The Book of St. Albans was fully digitised ahead of the recent feast day of St. Alban, on Wednesday, June the 22nd. Librarian and college archivist Helen Shenton said, "The Library of Trinity College Dublin is delighted to make this medieval masterpiece accessible to a global audience. For the first time in history, this exquisite manuscript by one of the world's most famous medieval artists and chroniclers, Matthew Paris, may be viewed digitally, revealing its beautiful artistry in full colour." Manuscript's curator, Estelle Gittins, said, "This astonishing manuscript contains some of the most incredible medieval art. It is a window into an elaborate world of saints, kings, and knights, but also sailors, builders, and bell ringers. Before now, the only way to study all of the images in this important manuscript was to consult the rare black and white 1924 facsimile edition. It is so exciting that this can now be viewed and enjoyed by everyone at the click of a button."
First Peace Bench. A ceremony will be taking place next week to bless St Albans' very first Peace Bench. The bench sits in Waxhouse Gate passageway outside Vintry Garden and depicts white birds of peace in the same style as one nearby commemorating the centenary of the First World War. It was funded by Conservation 50, using fees from talks for the Cathedral Adult Learning Programme given by Chairman Professor Tim Boatswain. He said, "It seems entirely appropriate that next to a bench that reminds us of the tragedy of war, there is a symbol of hope and peace. Can I give my thanks and pass on the gratitude of Conservation 50 for all of you who attended these talks and made the fulfilment of this project possible?" The Dean of the Cathedral, the Very Reverend Joe Kelly Moore, has agreed to bless the bench at a ceremony on June the 27th at 12:30 p.m. to which everyone is invited.
St Albans Woman offers heartfelt account of living with Parkinson's disease. A St Albans woman with Parkinson's disease has offered a candid insight into her journey following her diagnosis 8 years ago. Mother of three, Margaret Stone, 79, was left shocked after her GP said a frozen shoulder might be a neurological condition and underwent 18 months of tests and scans before finally receiving confirmation that she had Parkinson's. Her subsequent experiences recently led to her appearing in a national newspaper calling for better resources for identifying and treating people with the condition. Margaret explained, "There has been a lot of progress in the knowledge and earlier diagnosis of PD in the medical profession over the last 10 years, all of which is good. I have taken part in several research projects, many of which are to do with ways to detect the presence of PD long before any of the more obvious and debilitating symptoms occur." The former primary school teacher said following her diagnosis, she was not in a good place either physically, emotionally, and mentally, but joining the West Hearts branch of Parkinson's UK set her on a positive path to begin living her life again. "I took part in a program called STABLE, Staying Active with Big Limb Exercises, run by a physiotherapist and an occupational therapist, who were excellent in showing me the way forward to a better quality of life. I signed up for a 6-mile walk to raise money for Parkinson's UK, which I did with my twin daughters, my son-in-law, and one of my grandsons. I have an annual swim membership at Westminster Lodge where I usually go 2 or 3 times a week, and I go to a dancing music and movement class weekly. I try to exercise and walk each day, and although I am often tired and finding life quite a trial, exercising to strengthen my posture always helps. Many people tell me I am a different person from how I was years ago, and it is true my confidence gradually returned, and before the pandemic I was travelling again, on my own, making several trips abroad, including 2 amazing journeys to South Africa and Victoria Falls in Zimbabwe. She asked for a greater understanding of the challenges faced by those with the condition. People with Parkinson's are managing different problems and coping with a variety of difficulties, many of which even their family and friends will be unaware. But Margaret also is keen to highlight the support she has received. The people you meet along your journey with Parkinson's can make a huge difference on how you cope and on your quality of life. Small things can cause emotional distress. For no reason, you find yourself in floods of tears. Equally, unexpected encouragement empowers. Suddenly you're strong and positive, standing up straight and looking the world in the eye. Many people with conditions like PD would benefit from getting help quickly, be it with their GP, consultant, and less obviously from physiotherapists, occupational therapists, speech therapists, mental health and other counsellors, care workers, cleaners, gardeners, dentists, and maybe from you if you know someone with PD. Perhaps your words or actions will be just what is needed to keep them from harm and that 999 call. For more information on Parkinson's disease, including early warning signs and support post-diagnosis, visit parkinsons.org.uk.
My third reading is entitled Clock Tower Reopens After Essential Repairs. The St Albans Clock Tower was officially reopened by Mayor Jeff Harrison on Saturday following the completion of essential roof repairs. The tower usually opens on Good Friday, but this year the opening had to be delayed due to the discovery of rotten wood in the roof decking, leading to the whole platform needing to be replaced. As the building is a scheduled monument and a Grade 1 listed building, permissions had to be sought from both Culture Secretary Nadine Dorris and Historic England before work could commence. The initial cherry picker that the roofing contractors used to lift the wooden planks to the roof was not quite tall enough. The shorter sections of wood could be brought in through the second floor window and carried up the spiral staircase, but not the longer strips. A second, higher-reaching cherry picker was hired for the second day, and the longer pieces were finally hoisted to the roof and the decking completed. Whilst the tower was closed for the decking replacement, other internal repairs and replacements took place, and the Victorian turret clock was serviced by Smiths of Derby. The clock was corrected not only for the change due to British summertime, but also for the 12 minutes that it had lost gradually since its last service. The timing of the clock can be adjusted by adding small weights to the penny shelf on the pendulum, as this has the effect of speeding the clock up. The timing of the turret clock in the Palace of Westminster's Elizabeth Tower is adjusted in exactly the same way, only they have shiny old pre-decimal one pennies, and we have a collection of washers and metal nuts as our weights. The St Albans Clock Tower is now open every weekend and bank holiday from 10:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. until the end of September. It is staffed by volunteers from both SAHAAS, St Albans and Hertfordshire Architectural and Archaeological Society, and the St Albans Civic Society.
St Albans Music and Fizz Festival, fundraising for refugees. Preparations are underway for St Albans' fourth Beer and Fizz Festival. The annual event, which takes place at St Saviour's Church, is being held on July the 8th to the 10th, and money raised will go to the charity St Albans for Refugees. There will be a food market offering local produce, live music from individuals, bands and choirs, as well as real ale, lager, champagnes and sparkling wines. Father Richard Watson said, St Saviour's Beer and Fizz Festival is probably St Albans' fastest growing community event. Last year, around 1,200 people came through the doors over the weekend. And now in its fourth year, the generous sponsorship of local pubs and businesses has more than doubled. So this year will be bigger and better than ever. With a full programme of live music, from indie rock to jazz and community choirs, the church is a unique venue for some of the best of the city's musicians, and there really is nothing else like it. And because we want to include everyone, Sunday is always our family day, with kids' activities, a bouncy castle, and this year a really exciting collaboration with Books on the Hills Festival of Culture, offering a midday story time. The proceeds go towards church funds and this year's festival charity, St Albans for Refugees, which is really important. But above all else, the festival is about community and bringing people together.
Cyclists complete daylight dash from Darlington. A duo of determined cyclists have completed an epic 260-mile ride from Darlington to St Albans in one day. Richard Witter and Christian Mathieson cycle the distance in aid of the Hearts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust and the ME Association. Richard said, "We made it back for sunset at 9:17 p.m. and have raised £2,500. It was an amazing experience. To be heading pretty much due south all day and see the sun track from east to west was incredible. The weather was brilliant. It was a unique, if slightly bonkers, way to mark the longest day. In terms of achieving it, we were on such a tight schedule that we really had to minimise time off the bike, so stops for water or comfort breaks had to be super efficient. The funniest moment for me came about 12 hours in, when bits of me were beginning to hurt. I had a pack of paracetamol in my bag, but my wife had stuck motivational Go Dad Go stickers all over my gear before I packed. The sticker was covering the paracetamol, so I couldn't open it." And there is a picture of two very triumphant-looking cyclists holding their pints of beer at the end of the ride.
Remembering Michael Weaver, Mr. Harpenden. Tributes have been paid to a stalwart of the local business community, much-loved entrepreneur, politician, and raconteur. Michael Weaver was best known as the owner of C&A Builders Merchants, sited at 29 High Street, Harpenden, and later at Kingston House, 6 High Street, a hardware shop which drew custom from well beyond the immediate township. It was Michael who installed the very distinctive clock which still stands proudly on the front of the building. He'd said, "There had often been talk of a town clock, and as owner of the C&A business, I decided to install a three-way facing clock," he told the Hearts ad in 2012. First moving to Harpenden in 1968, he immediately became involved with the local community, including various charities and business groups. Some of his achievements include running the London Marathon in 1982, 1983, and 1985, competing in London to Brighton bike rides, and with the help of his Spurs football hero, the late Jimmy Greaves, he and his son, Robert, climbed Kilimanjaro for the charity WizKids. He started penning his autobiography, It's Not Over Until It's Over, while lying in bed in the Luton and Dunstable Hospital for several weeks, proceeds from which were recently presented to Keach Hospice. He said at the time, "Right from day one, I made it clear there was no desire to make any money out of this. I just wanted to describe all the ups and downs in my life, my love for Harpenden, running my old shop, C&A, becoming a local councillor, and particularly getting across the enjoyment of that life with my family. It's all been so worthwhile." Some of the organisations he was involved with include St Albans and District Chamber of Commerce, he was president in 1979, Harpenden Rotary Club, Harpenden first as a governor and director of St Hilda's School, and as a local councillor, including a stint as Harpenden mayor in 2011. His theme for the year was working together, and he stressed that it would listen to what people wanted. It is Harpenden first above all else, he said. He added, I treat the office of town mayor as the greatest honour that could be bestowed on me. Michael was well remembered for installing the Diamond Jubilee Arch in Thompson's Close without final planning permission, and felt passionately about preserving Harpenden High Street, and successfully campaigned on behalf of retailers against pedestrianising Lower High Street. He was a regular contributor to the letters pages of the Hearts Advertiser, waxing lyrical on whatever matters of local interest incited his passion. He maintained his interest in local businesses after his retirement and continued to offer advice at St Albans enterprise agency Stanter until very recently. Friend Robert Hill said, he was a big man with a big heart who gave of himself so generously to many people and organisations and achieved so much. Ginny Cooper, director of operations at Stanter, said, Michael's relentless cheerfulness, good heart and fighting spirit was an inspiration to many in St Albans Chamber of Commerce and his clients at Stanter. He particularly enjoyed the annual Chamber's St George's Day lunch, in which he participated with great gusto and will be remembered for using his sticks as a pretend arrow while singing Jerusalem. The business community in St Albans and Harpenden has lost a truly wonderful gentleman. St Albans Chamber of Commerce added, Michael has been such a great friend, participant and enthusiast, not just for the Chamber, but also Stanter and other organisations in the district. He was renowned for his championing of local people and local business, especially in Harpenden, with fairness and care. We will all miss him hugely. He leaves his wife, Roz, children, Claire, Robert, Sophie, and Victoria, and 8 grandchildren. Michael C. Weaver, July 1939 to June 2022.
My next article is entitled Harpenden Pupils Win International Flower Bulb Planting Award. Pupils at a Harpenden primary school have won the English round of an international nature competition. Class N6 at Roundwood Primary were the winners of the 2022 Golden Flower Bulb Award, achieved by participating in the Bulbs for Kids Flower Bulb Planting Project, which also included a photo and video competition. Schools from 6 countries, including the Netherlands, Germany, Canada, France and Sweden, were recognised for their work introducing primary age children to the world of nature through fun and interesting classroom activities. Roundwood Primary demonstrated their green fingers with nearly every child from nursery to year 6, planting bulbs in their newly created sensory garden, and the gardening club starting their own allotment. The school believes incorporating the natural environment within the curriculum and having hands-on experiences with plants contributes to pupils' healthy, balanced development. Head teacher Kate Hooft said she thrilled to hear that out of the 400 participating schools in England, Roundwood Primary were the overall winners for this competition. Everyone that saw our displays back in the spring commented on how lovely they looked. I feel so proud that we have won, although the real benefit has been that by planting and caring for the bulbs, the children have appreciated nature and how to care for the environment. It was great to be involved in this competition and an amazing collective effort from the whole school.
And that's the end of the news. Now the list of people whose deaths were announced in this week's edition of the Hearts Advertiser. Jack Chandler, aged 93 years. Margaret Chenery, aged 88. Betty Fuller, aged 95. Maureen O'Donovan, aged 69. And Winifred Stanlake, aged 98. Now, a little more of Rendezvous by Gothby, and then we'll have our selection of interesting national radio programmes coming up this week, which, for a change, as I said earlier, is read by Rob.
This week's radio listings is rather shorter than usual, owing to a slight mix-up among the team. Two of them thought it was their turn last week, and none of them is available this week. So, as one of the programme producers, I've stepped in to cover. It's something I've done many times before, because I started this whole programme off with another colleague years ago, so I'm quite used to researching and writing the script, but this time I've got a rather less time than usual. So let's start with Saturday the 25th of June. Lots of the usual programmes on Radio 4, The Week in Westminster at 11 a.m, from our own correspondent at 11:30, Moneybox just after the news at midday, Dead Ringers at 12:30, Any Questions, that's the repeat from Friday the night before, at 1:10, and Any Answers at 2 p.m. At 7:15 p.m. on Radio 4, there's a new series of The Infinite Money Cage, with the ever-present Professor Brian Cox and Robin Ince. This week, the topic is bats and flies. Could be interesting. Archive on 4 focuses on the 100-year-old ever-present influence in international affairs, Henry Kissinger. He's just published a book about some of the world leaders he's encountered, including de Gaulle and Nixon, Chairman Xi and Putin, so this is his chance to promote the book. If you prefer to listen to the Test match between England and New Zealand, that's over on Radio 4 Longwave on Test Match Special all day. Now moving on to Sunday the 26th, again plenty of the regular shows on Radio 4, including Broadcasting House at 9 a.m, The Archers Omnibus from 10 a.m, Desert Island Discs at 11:15 with U2 frontman Bono chatting with Lauren Laverne this week. The food programme's on at midday, and of course, Gardener's Question Time returns at 2 p.m. The drama at 3 p.m. on Radio 4 is the first of a two-parter, Someone at a Distance. It's been adapted from the final novel of a largely forgotten writer of the 1930s and 40s, Dorothy Whipple. Open Book on Radio 4 at 4 p.m. brings two current novelists, Michelle Gallen and James Cahill, as they chat about their new novels with the host, Chris Powell. Monday the 27th is the chance for the first daily dose of BBC Radio 3's Composer of the Week. And this week it's the American jazz musician Billy Strayhorn, whose life began in poverty and with a violent father. Also on Radio 3 each day at 10 p.m. is the 45-minute regular programme Free Thinking. A different topic each day, but always a challenging discussion. Monday is, of course, the start for various programmes that then follow on each day through the week, including Book of the Week on Radio 4 at 9:45 a.m. This week it's based on the book by Eddie Young, which explores the world as it's truly perceived by other animals. At 10 a.m, a programme I try to catch whenever I can, Woman's Hour, with a brilliant Emma Barnett, a truly top-class presenter and interviewer. She really does her work before the programme. At 1:45 on Radio 4 is the time for a tough series of 15-minute pieces about forgiveness, stories from the front line, and it features people who've had to struggle with forgiveness in order to be free. Front Row is at 7:15 on Radio 4 each day, Monday to Friday. And the book at bedtime on Radio 4 will run for 2 weeks. It's called Mother's Boy by that wonderful writer Patrick Gale, and inspired by the early life in the 1920s, of the Cornish poet Charles Causley. Tuesday at 11 a.m. offers another in the series, The Secrets of Storytelling. In this week's episode, James Rees is joined by Anne Enright to discuss the craft of writing dialogue. It's a great series looking into the work of a novelist. Drama at 2:15 on Radio 4 is the second part of Lifelines, the first part having been on Monday. It's set in an ambulance call centre and it's described as an award-winning drama. At 4 p.m. on 4, Joshua Rosenberg asks whether the human rights of older people need special protection through an international convention. Also, Lady Rose of the Supreme Court shares her views on what makes a good judge. File on 4 at 8 p.m. looks at last month's independent review on children's social care, which concluded that providing care for children in residential homes, quotes, should not be based on profit, unquote. Tom Wall investigates the companies that are making huge profits from children's homes. On to Wednesday the 29th, and at 3 p.m. on Radio 4, Moneybox Live offers advice on financial matters, something we all need in these difficult times. And at 4 p.m. on Radio 4, The Caretakers continues. Artist Eloise Moody gathers the thoughts of people who are responsible for cultural treasures in Britain's museums. Thursday the 30th, and it's Kate Adie at 11 a.m. with her regular reports from around the world from our own correspondent. Then at 11:30 a.m. part 4 of Fairy Meadow with John Kay, continuing the sad tale of 3-year-old Cheryl Granger, who went missing from an Australian beach almost 50 years ago. 8:30 p.m. is time for The Bottom Line with Evan Davis, asking whether there's a place for wokeness in capitalism. And finally, to Friday the 1st of July, at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, Dark Corners visits Aberlour House and Gordonstoun to look at class, power and privilege in elite schools. Just after the news at midday, still on Radio 4, Adam Fleming investigates an issue of the day, taking a topic that's being fiercely debated right now. At 3 p.m. on 4, Gardener's Question Time comes from the wonderful Swiss garden at the Shuttleworth Estate in Bedfordshire. And at 4 p.m. on the same station, Matthew Bannister celebrates the lives of notable people who've recently died. It's another of my favourites because it celebrates the lives of some fascinating people. So, apologies for the fact this is a shorter preview than usual, for reasons I explained at the outset. And having to step back into this preview seat for the first time in many years, I'm as ever struck by the amazing range of programmes to be found on the BBC. How can anyone even consider squeezing it even harder? It's a brilliant producer in the brilliant medium called radio.
Now we have a selection of audio-described TV programmes coming up this week. And this is from Otley Talking News, so many thanks to them.
Hello to you all. This is John from Otley Talking News, selecting and reading my choice of audio-described television programmes for the week commencing Saturday the 25th of June and ending Friday the 1st of July. This week is the start of Wimbledon fortnight, so many programmes are, let's say, adjusted. This weekend it's also Glastonbury, so there's a lot of that taking up the airwaves. As both of these are live, there's no audio description, but the commentary may help. Starting with Saturday 25th of June, Jeremy Pang's Asian Kitchen is on ITV at 11:35. Jeremy creates dishes perfect for family feasts. This programme is repeated tomorrow at 9:55 a.m. James Martin's French Adventure continues on ITV at 12:40. The chef serves barbecued duck with a spicy apple and pear chutney. The feature film on BBC Two this afternoon at 1:20 is Casablanca, the classic romantic drama starring Humphrey Bogart and Ingrid Bergman. Did you miss Back in Time for Birmingham? If so, there's a chance to catch up on BBC Two at 3 p.m. with parts 1 and 2. Part 3 of Madame Blanc's Mysteries is on Channel 5 at 7. It's Judith and Jeremy's wedding anniversary party, but it takes a sinister turn when her sister is found dead. There's the Bond film, The Spy Who Loved Me, on ITV at 8 p.m. James set out to stop an evil shipping magnet and finds help in the unlikely shape of a beautiful KGB agent. There's a new series on Channel 4 at 8, Lost Treasures of Rome. In this first episode, archaeologists investigate why a slave in Pompeii ended up as a wealthy man buried, not cremated, in his own family enclosure. There's a double edition of Casualty on BBC One starting at 8:50. In Blame Game, Stevie clashes with a new colleague. And then at 9:30, in One In, One Out, Rash makes a shocking discovery about his older patients, Bertie and Simrat. If tennis is your thing, the film Borg vs. McEnroe is on BBC Two at 10:30. Based on a true story, Borg is vying to win his fifth title in a row, but there's a new kid on the block, John McEnroe, and he has beaten Borg three times out of their last seven previous meetings. Let's go on to Sunday, the 26th of June. Simply Raymond Blanc is on ITV at 10:55 a.m. The chef prepares cheese fondue and celeriac remoulade. There are more Homes Under the Hammer on BBC One at 11:30 a.m. And this is followed still on One with Bargain Hunt at 12 noon. The Hairy Biker's Asian Adventure at 12:30 on BBC Two. Dave and Cy meet a geisha in Kyoto. The Radio Times film of the week is Monsters, Inc., an animated comedy. You can see it on BBC One at 2:55. The inhabitants of Monstropolis are in an energy crisis. Their energy comes from Earth's children's screams, which they collect at night. But one night they accidentally return with an unfazed human child in tow. This causes a whole lot of trouble. McDonald and Dodds is on ITV at 8. The duo are sucked into the fast and furious world of Formula One after a promising young driver dies in suspicious circumstances. Also at 8, Channel 4 has the concluding part of Tutankhamun's Secrets of the Tomb. Ella Al-Shahami visits the new network of undisturbed tombs. Can the ancient mummies help solve the mystery of King Tut's curse? BBC One continues Series 2 of The Outlaws at 9 p.m. The Brook Hill crew is doing well, and tonight's episode has fun with the contrast between what the police expect from a thriving drugs empire and the reality of a bunch of oddballs busking it. Also on 9, but on Channel 4, another new series, which is being shown at this time, tonight, Monday and Tuesday, Murder in the Alps. Almost 10 years ago, Said Al-Hilli and his British family were brutally murdered in the Alps. The case remains unsolved. This seemingly random killing took on the air of an ordered execution when strange items are found in the family holiday caravan. Former investigators and the brother of one of the victims tell the story of the police sprawling investigation that continues to this day. ITV also has, at 10:20, Kelly Holmes Being Me. In this personal film, Dame Kelly Holmes opens up about the significant periods in her life and their impact on her mental health. This is repeated at 11:40 on Thursday, 29th of June. Now look at programmes that are on the same time each weekday, which may be affected by the tennis at Wimbledon. On BBC One, Homes Under the Hammer at 11:15 and Bargain Hunt at 12:15, but neither of these are on Wednesday due to the tennis. Dickinson's Real Deal is on ITV at 2 p.m. EastEnders moves to BBC Two at 7:30, but is not transmitted on Friday. All the other soaps are still on at their usual times. Downton Abbey is on ITV3 at 5:50 p.m. and Heartbeat is on ITV3 at 7 p.m. Looking now at programmes on Monday the 27th of June. Food Unwrapped Breakfast Buffet on Channel 4 at 8. Kate Quilton discovers why some egg yolks are more yellow than others, and Bryony May Williams goes in search of the ultimate bacon butty. BBC One has Extraordinary Portraits at 8:30. Artist Lolo celebrates the bravery of a semi-professional footballer, Jamal Howlett Mundell, for coming out as bisexual last year. On BBC One at 9 is part 5 of Sherwood. As the manhunt closes in on the murder suspects, the action flashes back to the village in 1984, and the identity of the spy is revealed. The final programme is tomorrow at 9. Part 3 of Long Lost Families on ITV at 9. The team help two individuals searching for their birth mothers. Don't forget part 2 of Murder in the Alps at 9 on Channel 4. AIDS The Unheard Tapes is on BBC 2 at 9:30. In Ignorance, 40 years ago a mysterious disease first appeared in Britain's gay community, and a group of researchers recorded audio interviews with infected men and their friends. There's a repeat of last Wednesday's The Savoy at 10:45 on ITV. A mystery hotel inspector is expected. Channel 4 at 10 p.m. has Ukraine, life under attack. First-hand accounts of the battle for Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, from civilians and emergency workers who bore the brunt of the Russian attack. Now on to Tuesday 28th of June. On Channel 5 at 8, The Yorkshire Vet. Julian gets to grips with a boar who has a large lump on his neck. Meanwhile, Peter treats former Middlesbrough FC footballer's beloved Irish setter. Also 8, but on BBC Two, Saving Lives at Sea. Volunteers in Hampshire try to rescue the crew of a 50,000-ton cargo ship that has hit a sandbank. It's the final part of Sherwood on BBC One at 9. In a bid to protect them, Ian is more determined than ever to find the spy. It's also the final part of Murder in the Alps on Channel 4 at 9. Why has so much attention been on the brother Zayd Al-Hilli? Royal History's Biggest Fibs with Lucy Worsley is on BBC 4 at 9. Lucy explores some of the myths swirling around the French Revolution of 1798. And Michael Rapport explains how the revolution wasn't started by peasants, but sparked by a group of lawyers and property owners. Why buildings collapse? Find out on BBC Two at 9:30. On June 24th, 2021, the Chamberlain Towers South, a 13-story residential building in Florida, collapsed in 12 seconds, leaving 98 people dead. This film examines the factors that might have led to the collapse and explore implications for other buildings around the world, including Britain. If you've been watching The Bridge, Race to a Fortune, it's the penultimate episode tonight at 10 on Channel 4. Both sides are given a chance to bid for a carpenter to join their team. On to Wednesday 29th of June, and let's start with The Repair Shop on BBC One at 8:30. The team tackle an unusual timepiece in the form of a barmaid holding a pendulum clock, a precious handmade mirror, and an Eames chair. It's the final of the Great British Sewing Bee on BBC One at 9. In the challenges tonight, the sewers must devise something stunning from scraps from their previous challenges. The Prince's Master Crafters is on Sky Arts, preview channel 11, at 8 p.m. And it's the final. The students must impress the Prince with their graduation piece. Part 3 of the Savoy is on ITV at 9. The American Bar has recently undergone a makeover, and the team must prepare for the reopening. Will the venue retain its classic ambiance? The second and concluding part of Lenny Henry's Caribbean Britain is on BBC Two at 9:30. Lenny explores how he and other second and third generation British-born Caribbean youngsters meshed their identities with their art in the theatre and art collectives of the 1980s. It's the final part of The Bridge Race to a Fortune on Channel 4 at 10. It's neck and neck as the teams approach the island and the jackpot. The winning side must then vote for just one of them to take the prize home. But who? Thursday, the 30th of June, Sarah Beeny's Little House, Big Plans is on Channel 4 at 8. Chrissy and Nick from Poole bought a 1930s semi in which they want to create an open-plan kitchen diner. And in London, Graham and Stephen have transformed their Victorian terraced house into a modern home. There's a new thriller on Channel 4 at 9, Undeclared War. Student Sarah starts a work experience placement at GCHQ, but on her first day, during a telecommunications security stress test, a significant part of the UK's internet goes down due to an attack, leading to a high-stakes battle of cyber warfare. It's the final part of 13 on BBC Three at 9 p.m. Ivy is forced to confront the truth. Also at 9, but on BBC One, is Who Do You Think You Are? Tonight featuring Ralph Little. He learns that his grandfather was involved in one of World War II's most important battles. He confirms that, once as a serious footballer himself, he had followed another family member who was a Welsh international football player. There's another chance to see Sunday's McDonald and Dodds at 10:45 on ITV. Finally, to Friday the 1st of July. If you missed Monsters, Inc. last Sunday, there's another chance to see it on ITV3 at 7 p.m. Great fun. Why not watch it twice? as A Midsummer Murder on ITV3 at 8, in Death and the Divas, It Looks Like Life is Imitating Art, when the murder of a journalist echoes the scene from a 1960s horror movie starring Midsummer's own Stella Harris. This Is My House on BBC One at 8:30, a 9-bedroom Georgian mansion complete with ice room, pirate room, yoga studio and an indoor beach, is owned by Roni, but three others also say they own it. It's up to Richard Madeley, Judy Love and Harry Hill to deduce who is telling the truth. Part 3 of Sanditon is on ITV at 9. Charlotte sets out to avoid Sydney until a serious accident forces them together and to reappraise each other. The late film on ITV at 10:45 is Fast and Furious 8. Vin Diesel stars in this action adventure. The team have dispersed to live quiet lives, but Dom is seduced into a life of techno-terrorism by the mysterious Cypher. The opportunity for the team to put their feet up will have to wait. I hope you find something of interest in my selection this week.
Now we have the item from TNF Soundings about the Order of St. John, the origin of the St. John's Ambulance Brigade.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
This is about the work of the Order of St. John. This year, the Order of St. John in Scotland is celebrating the 75th anniversary of its re-establishment there. Although the Order has been in existence for 1,000 years, it remains relatively unknown, and its world-class eye hospital, providing eye operations for Israelis and Palestinians alike in Jerusalem and on the West Bank, hardly ever gets the credit it deserves. The exact date when the Order of the Hospital of St. John of Jerusalem first came into being is unknown. However, it was around 1070 when a hospice, a place of care, was established in Jerusalem by monks from a neighbouring Benedictine abbey to care for the growing number of Christians making the long and dangerous pilgrimage to the Holy City. The hospice soon developed into a hospital, and in 1113, the Pope confirmed its independence. Over the next 40 years, it developed into a religious and military order, with its brothers and sisters, commonly known as Hospitallers of St. John or Knights Hospitallers, providing care to the poor and sick of any faith. They also took on the additional role of defending all Christians and others within their care when they were threatened. The order was driven out of Jerusalem in 1187 by adherents of the rising religion of Islam and established its headquarters at Acre on the coast of Palestine before being pushed out of there to Cyprus and then on to Rhodes. In 1530, it settled in Malta, where it governed until it was expelled by Napoleon in 1798. Throughout their sovereign years on Rhodes and Malta, the Knights' medical work continued. In Rhodes, the hospital had separate wards for infectious disease and maternity care. In Malta, the order ran a health service for the Maltese people and set up a famous school of anatomy and surgery. The great ward in Malta's hospital was the longest room in 18th century Europe. From the beginning, the order grew rapidly and was given land throughout Western Europe. Its estates were managed by small groups of brothers and sisters who lived in communities that provided resources to the headquarters of the order. These communities were gradually gathered into provinces called priories or grand priories. In Britain, these estates were first administered from one of the communities at Clerkenwell in London from about 1140, and the original priory church was built at the same time. In 1540, the order was suppressed by King Henry VIII as part of the dissolution of the monasteries. It was restored and incorporated by Queen Mary I in 1557, but when Queen Elizabeth I again confiscated all its estates in 1559, she did so without annulling its incorporation. These acts by English sovereigns didn't directly affect the order in Scotland, but the influence of the Reformation ended the order's activities there in about 1564. The order in Britain then fell into abeyance. The religious order of the Hospital of St. John which is now formally known as the Sovereign Military Hospitaller Order of St. John of Jerusalem, of Rhodes and of Malta, went through a time of disarray after it was expelled from Malta, but it had recovered by the middle of the 19th century when its headquarters were established in Rome. The Roman Catholic arm is still often called the Order of Malta, and its members are frequently referred to as Knights of Malta. In the 1820s, the Knights of Malta, living in France, offered knighthoods to specific people supporting the order in Great Britain, irrespective of their Christian denomination. Their approach was not part of the official policy of the Order of Malta, but the English knights devoted themselves to charitable activities, which were organised into what became known as foundations. It was this British group carrying out very substantial charitable activities which Queen Victoria recognised and incorporated in 1888, and which became the modern, substantially Protestant Order of St. John. Victoria ruled the largest empire the world had ever known, and the Order saw it as part of its role to spread Western medical practice to the colonies. Today, St. John is still active in over 40 countries across the world. Britain was one of the first countries to become industrial, and in the 19th century, there were many dangerous workplaces. Conditions and machinery were hazardous, and workers were exhausted by the long hours. Accidents were frequent, but workers rarely saw a doctor in time. Death or disability from untreated injuries was common. Members of the British Order wanted to find a way to help. They decided to train ordinary people in first aid, so accident victims could be treated quickly and on the spot, and in 1877 they set up St. John Ambulance to do this. Classes were set up across the country, particularly in workplaces and areas of heavy industry, but also in villages, seaside towns and middle-class suburbs. In 1887, trained volunteers were organised into a uniformed brigade to provide a first aid and ambulance service at public events. In many parts of Britain, St. John was the first and only provider of an ambulance service right up to the middle of the 20th century, when the National Health Service was founded. When there were far fewer doctors and hospital beds than there are today, St. John nurses looked after the sick and injured in their own homes. There were originally three charitable foundations of the modern order, one which became the St. John of Jerusalem Eye Hospital Foundation, was established in 1882. The St. John Ambulance Association, which was concerned with training the public in first aid, was established in 1877. And the third was the St. John Ambulance Brigade, which provided first aid care to the public. It had its origins in 1873 and became a foundation in 1887. St. John Ambulance Association and the St. John Ambulance Brigade were amalgamated in 1974, to form the present St. John Ambulance Foundation. In Scotland, St. John gave way to the St. Andrew's organisation in 1908 and hasn't provided an ambulance service there since. There was a major restructuring of the Order's constitution in 1999. This introduced a new governing body called the Grand Council. The Order today consists of 8 St. John national organisations known as priories, 33 St. John national organisations known as associations, and the St. John Eye Hospital Group, which has its main hospital in Jerusalem. The St. John of Jerusalem Eye Hospital Group has been operating for 140 years and is the only charitable provider of eye care and the main provider for Palestinians in Jerusalem. The original site of the Eye Hospital was in the old city of Jerusalem in Muristan. Muristan's the area where Christian, Jewish and Muslim quarters of the old city meet. The Jerusalem Hospital and the Muristan Clinics are historic stone buildings with beautiful gardens that require preserving and maintaining to ensure the order can keep our staff and patients safe. Today, the Muristan Clinic serves the residents of the old city from this original site, providing walk-in access to eye care, which can be crucial in saving sight. The clinic's Peace Garden provides an oasis for patients and staff who need some respite from the bustling city, and the Order hopes that in time the Peace Gardens will be open to tourists to learn more about the life-changing work of St. John in the Holy Land. Over 2,700 major operations on adults and over 500 on children are carried out at the Jerusalem Hospital each year. The outpatient department in Jerusalem treats over 33,000 adults and over 16,000 children every year. Doing all this is expensive. It costs somewhere over £2 million for the Jerusalem Hospital facility, which is by far the largest and requires the most investment to keep these services available to those who need them most. St. John also provides essential sight-saving and life-changing eye care to the most remote and impoverished communities in the region for free. Its outreach clinics include the Anapta Clinic, Hebron Hospital, Gaza Hospital, and two mobile outreach vans visiting remote villages in the West Bank and Gaza. Together, they serve a population of 2.5 million people. The order's belief is that by protecting sight, it's safeguarding the financial and social independence of people of all ages across the West Bank and Gaza, and donations help to maintain and expand that vital work. Running the Gaza facility, where the order recently opened a second operating theatre, costs £1,325,000 annually. In 2019, over 26,000 adults and 6,600 children were treated at the Gaza Hospital, and the order also runs a mobile outreach programme in Gaza. Hebron Hospital costs £610,000, and in 2019, nearly 8,000 adults and 4,500 children were treated there. In the same year, over 12,000 adults and 5,600 children were treated at the Anabta Clinic at an annual cost of £531,000. The West Bank Mobile Outreach Programme includes two vans, and they cost £500,000. There were funding challenges to the Mobile Outreach Programme, but thanks to some very generous donations, that programme continued to be funded. Thanks to this funding, the aim is to reach more than 10,000 people and educate more than 7,500 people through 201 health education sessions. Nowadays, back here in Britain, the order welcomes members of all denominations and all faiths and none at all, as it changes with the times, but still provides life-saving medical help to everyone who may need it.
TNS Soundings.
Now we have the repeat of episode 3 of the new series of the 10 Today Exercise Programme.
Hello everyone, this is 10 Today, a 10-minute set of exercises to do at home to help keep yourself active. Before we get to today's presenter, a couple of housekeeping points to note. The 10 Today project is funded by the Big Lottery and Sport England, and when you're doing the exercises, it's important that you don't push yourself too far, and by taking part, you agree to 10 Today's terms and conditions. You can read these terms and conditions at tnflink.uk/10T, and the 10T is the digit 1, the digit 0, and the letter T. And please remember that you agree to take part at your own risk. Today's exercises are brought to you by Jeff, and here he is.
Hello everyone, and welcome to 10 Today, Series 2, Session number 3. These are short 10-minute physical activity routines which will get you moving and stretching. They're great for your health, including boosting your mood. And very importantly, they are designed to support your everyday movements, your functional fitness, your flexibility, balance, and mobility, such as when you have to reach up, turn, bend down, and so on. These simple routines will help you with that. Just take them at your own pace. There are plenty of options. If an exercise feels too much, then just take it easy and have a break. All the exercises can be done either sitting down or standing up. So just do whichever feels good for you today. When lifting your arms or knees, only go as far as is comfortable. If you have any problems with your knees or hips, take care not to twist them during the movements. It can also help to pull in your tummy when you are bending your back and just breathe normally throughout these activities. We want you all to do these activities safely. You're responsible for monitoring how you're feeling throughout the sessions, If you feel any discomfort or pain, for example, if you feel unwell or dizzy, or experience palpitations, then please stop and seek medical advice. Please remember you agree to take part at your own risk. If you're remaining seated, it would be ideal if you can use a hard chair, preferably one without arms, such as a dining chair, so that you can sit upright, with a straight back and with your feet flat on the floor. If you're standing, just step your feet hip width apart, relax your shoulders and take a good strong stance. And you might want to have a sturdy chair nearby to hold on for something for balance. We hope you enjoy 10 today, so we're just going to start with a warm-up. You're just going to quickly tap or pat different parts of your body. So briefly tap along each arm, one at a time, in different places. Your upper arm, your forearm, and your wrist. Do the same on both arms. Then pat the top of both legs, just quickly tapping up and down your legs in various places towards your knees for a few seconds. You should be nicely warmed up by now and ready to move. So we're going to start with butterfly wings. In the usual starting position, with your feet hip width apart and shoulders relaxed, lift both arms to shoulder height and bend your elbows so that one is pointing to the left and one to the right, with your hands facing each other in front of your chest. Now roll your shoulders backwards, letting your arms naturally follow the movement. If you're standing, you can bend your knees slightly at the same time. If you're sitting, you can press down through your feet. Continue rolling your shoulders backwards a few times. Then stop and roll your shoulders forwards this time to move your arms. You can make wider, higher circles if you can. Just do a couple more. This is great for your shoulders and arms. Now it's time for look back. Lean forwards and lower both arms down towards the floor, past your knees. Then swing your arms together slowly to the left, sweeping them all the way up to shoulder height if you can, or as high as possible. Raise your head and look up, following your arms with your eyes as they swing up towards your shoulders. Then lower both arms back down, past your legs, and swing them up to the right. So just keep swinging your arms slowly from left to right, going up to the left, coming back down to your legs, and then up to the right, remembering to raise your head and look up as your arms swing up. Keep going for a few more times, a bit further forward if you can. This is another good one for your arms and shoulders, as well as your balance. Next up is kick the ball. If you're standing, you can hold on to something sturdy, like a chair, for balance. So just raise your right leg and bring your knee up towards your body. Straighten your leg out in front of you as if you're about to kick a ball. Bend it again and return your foot to the floor. Then swap legs, lifting your left foot off the floor this time, bending your knees and then straightening that leg out in front of you. Pull it back and back down to the floor again. Keep going with this movement, just alternating your legs. So bend leg up, straighten out, pull back, and down again. That's good. A couple more times now, lifting your leg a little bit higher if you can. This is a great one for your balance and core. This next one is called look below. Step your feet a bit further apart to take a wider stance. Then lean forward, lowering both arms together towards your feet as far as is comfortable. Push your hands downwards with your palms facing down. Then just make some small circling motions with your hands, moving them outwards in opposite directions, as if you're polishing a table with a cloth in each hand. Straighten up and then lean forwards again. Lower your arms towards your feet and repeat these small circling movements. Do this a few more times, making bigger circles if you can, and with your legs a bit wider. This is another one that's good for your balance and your core muscles. Well done. Now it's time for rustling in the wind. Push both arms straight up above your head and slowly move your arms and wrists just like the branches rustling in the wind. Keep your feet still and facing forward, but turn your upper body to either side, twisting from the hips to get more movement. Keep moving those arms and hands above your head as if they're being swayed by a breeze. Then bring your arms back down by your sides in that comfortable starting position. Now push both arms back up again and do exactly the same thing, moving those arms and hands in a nice rustling motion and turning your upper body from side to side. You can wave a bit more wildly if you want to. This is really good for your arms, shoulders, and balance. Next up is look up to the moon. Start in the usual position with your feet hip-width apart and shoulders relaxed. If you're sitting, you can move forwards in your chair slightly so that you've got a bit more room to move. Just bend forwards, lowering your arms in front of your knees and slowly bring both arms together to the left, bringing them up around shoulder height. Then straighten your arms and put your palms forward in a pushing motion. Bring both arms back down and swing them to the right this time, past your knees again and up to shoulder height. Push from the elbows to straighten your arms. So swing the arms down, bring them back up and push. Do this a few more times on each side, alternating from left to right. Try and swing your arms a bit lower and a bit higher if you can. This is great for your shoulders, arms and core, as well as your balance. That's good work. Now we go into the fight. Step your right foot forward, bending your knee as far as comfortable into a lunge, and make sure your knee isn't reaching past your toes when you look down. Then make a fist and punch your right arm straight in front of you. Pull your arm back slowly towards your body and then punch up at an angle this time. Pull the arm back again and step back. Now change to the left side, stepping your left foot forward, bending at the knee and punching straight out with that left arm. Pull it back towards your body and then punch out at an angle upwards. Pull it back again and step back. Repeat this movement a few more times, alternating from left to right. You can punch out with a bit more power if you can, and with a bit longer lunge. This is so good for your legs and balance as well as your shoulders. Next up is repulse the current. Start with a wider stance this time by moving your feet a bit further apart. Point your toes out slightly, and if you're standing, bend your knees. You can also use your arms for balance if you're standing by putting them out in front of you. This is a squat position, ready to work the inner thighs. Now just raise both heels off the floor and lower them back down. So raising up onto the balls of the feet and onto the toes and then back down again. Repeat that up and down movement a few more times, feeling that pull on the inner thighs. Just go a little bit higher onto your toes if you can. This is great for your legs and balance. Well done. The next one is called knocking the sky. This is a nice simple movement, just raising a single arm straight above your head with your palm facing up. So starting with the right arm, push it straight up in the air, keeping it as straight as possible, and then bring it back down again to your side. Swap to the left arm and push that one up above your head. Keep it as straight as you can and then bring it back down again. Keep going, alternating those arms from left to right. Try and keep your arms as straight as you can and reach just a little bit higher. It's really good for your chest, arms, and wrists. And the last one is kick round. If you're standing, you can hold onto a sturdy chair for balance. Start by lifting your left leg with your knee bent to a comfortable height. With your knee leading, move your leg gently outwards to the left side in a circular motion, just as far as your capabilities allow, taking care with your hips. Then bring your foot back to the floor. Switch to the right leg and do exactly the same again. So you're lifting your right leg this time with the knee bent and moving your leg gently towards the right to make a small circle in the air. Repeat this a few more times on each side, alternating your legs each time. Try to lift your leg a little bit higher if it feels comfortable. This is great for your hip movement, legs, and your back. That's all the exercises. Well done. We're just going to finish with a quick shake to cool down. So raise both arms above your head towards the ceiling and just briefly wave your hands and arms in the air. Then lift one leg slightly from the floor if you can. Shake it out in the air for a second or two. Raise the other leg and shake that one out too. Or you can just shake your upper body instead. So that's the end of the session. Great work, everyone. We hope you enjoyed it. Doing 10 today, just 3 times a week, can have positive benefits for your physical health and improve your well-being too. It's short, it's fun, and you'll simply feel better, so do keep going.
We now have our piece of music, Rendezvous by Gothby, in its entirety. And now here are some well-known people whose birthdays fall this week. On the 25th of June 1961, Ricky Gervais, the comedian, actor, writer and director, was born in Reading, Berkshire. he started his career in the music business, but turned to comedy in the 1990s. He came to prominence with The Office in 2001, which he co-created and co-wrote with Stephen Merchant. He also took the starring role as David Brent, a middle manager of a large company with many idiosyncrasies, hypocrisies, and self-delusions. He followed this with Extras, also co-created and co-written with Stephen Merchant. He has starred in several other TV shows whilst continuing to perform stand-up comedy. On the 26th of June, 1943, Georgie Fame was born Clive Powell in Lee, Lancashire. When he was 16, he went to London where he was spotted by impresario Larry Parnes, who signed him up on condition he changed his stage name to Georgie Fame. Parnes had done the same thing to Marty Wilde, Billy Fury and several others. Powell was against the idea, but Parnes said, "No name change, no work." Georgie Fame is the only British artist to have had three number one UK hits with his only top 10 entries. Yeah Yeah in 1964, Get Away in 1966, and The Ballad of Bonnie and Clyde in 1967. Since then he has devoted his time to rhythm and blues and jazz, and still occasionally plays as a trio with his two sons. And I have a very tenuous connection with Georgie Fame, in that he was at school with my brother in Lee. On the 27th of June, 1962, Michael Ball, the singer, presenter and actor, was born in Bromsgrove, Worcestershire. He made his West End debut in 1985, playing Marius Pontmercy in the original London production of Les Miserables, and went on to star in shows such as The Phantom of the Opera, Passion, Aspects of Love, Giorgio and Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. In 1989, he reached number two in the singles chart with Love Changes Everything. He's twice won the Laurence Olivier Award for Best Actor in a Musical. He won in 2008 for his role as Edna Turnblad in Hairspray, and then in 2013 for the title role in the revival of Sweeney Todd, The Demon Barber of Fleet Street. In 1992, Ball represented the United Kingdom in the Eurovision Song Contest, finishing second with the song One Step Out of Time. In April 2020, Ball and Captain Tom Moore entered the UK singles chart at number one with a cover of You'll Never Walk Alone, and it was the fastest-selling single of 2020. On the 28th of June 1971, Elon Musk was born in Pretoria, South Africa. He is a billionaire businessman, founder of the spaceflight company SpaceX, CEO of Tesla Vehicles, amongst others, and is currently the richest man in the world, worth over $200 billion. He is not without controversy. He is a man of many opinions, and he has made various warnings about the threat of artificial intelligence to humans, which have been dismissed as irresponsible by experts in the field. He has been criticised for spreading misinformation about COVID-19. In September 2020, he stated he would not be getting the COVID vaccine as he was not at risk. 2 months later, he contracted COVID, and a year later, he revealed he had been vaccinated. He named his son, born in 2020, XAEAXII. X being his first name, and AEAXII being his middle name. I mean, obviously. The AXII part is a reference to the A-12 spy plane. Apparently, it's his favourite aircraft. I think it's safe to say he's quite an unusual man. On the 29th of June 1920, Ray Harryhausen, one of the pioneers of stop-motion animation films, was born in Los Angeles, California. Having had several viewings of the original release of King Kong in 1933, he was inspired to see the animator Willis O'Brien, who gave him much useful advice. He spent the Second World War making animated films for the US Army on the use of military equipment. After the war, his first film was The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms in 1953, which pioneered his technique of integrating animation with live action. This was followed in the 50s by such films as It Came from Beneath the Sea, Earth vs. the Flying Saucers, and The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. In the 60s and 70s, he was responsible for, amongst others, Jason and the Argonauts, regarded by many as his masterwork, 1 Million Years BC, and Clash of the Titans. He is widely regarded as one of the most influential animators of all time. On the 30th of June 1966, Mike Tyson, the former world heavyweight boxing champion, was born in New York City. He made his professional debut in 1985 and won 26 of his first 28 fights with knockouts, 16 of them being in the first round. In 1986, he defeated Trevor Burbick to become the youngest ever world heavyweight champion. He won 50 of his 58 fights, including 44 by knockouts, and is widely regarded as one of the greatest heavyweight boxers ever. However, his actions outside the ring have caused him and others many problems. His marriage to actress Robin Givens ended in acrimonious divorce amid reports of physical abuse. He was convicted of raping an 18-year-old woman in 1991, spending 4 years in prison, and he's had several convictions for drug use. He has been diagnosed with bipolar disorder. On the 1st of July, 1903, Amy Johnson, the pioneering pilot, was born in Hull, Yorkshire. In 1930, she became the first woman to fly solo from London to Australia, landing in Darwin. The de Havilland Gypsy moth she used, called Jason, is now on permanent display in the Science Museum in London. She made several more long-distance flights, from London to Tokyo, from South Wales to New York, Britain to India, and Britain to South Africa. During the Second World War, she was a member of the Air Transport Auxiliary and was lost in the Thames estuary when she bailed out in bad weather. The circumstances of her death are subject of controversy, as there have been unsubstantiated reports of a friendly fire incident. And finally, some notable events which happened this week in the past. On the 25th of June 1950, the Korean War started when North Korean troops crossed into South Korea under the auspices of the Soviet Union and Communist China. The United Nations denounced the invasion and authorized military force to repel it. It could only do this because the Soviet Union had boycotted the UN because of its recognition of Taiwan. The Soviet Union never made that mistake again. 21 countries led by the USA contributed to the UN force. The front line went back and forth until it stabilized at the 38th parallel, where it had started. After 3 years of heavy fighting, an armistice was signed in July 1953. But a peace treaty was never agreed, and to this day, North and South Korea are still technically at war. On the 26th of June, 1483, Richard, Duke of York, became King Richard III, the last Plantagenet monarch. When the previous king, Edward IV, died in 1483, Richard was appointed Lord Protector of Edward IV's sons, the new king, 12-year-old Edward V, and his younger brother, Richard, aged 10. The two young princes lived in the Tower of London, which was a royal residence at the time. Due to political skullduggery, the marriage of the old king was deemed bigamous, so the young princes were declared illegitimate. Thus, Richard was seen to be the rightful king. The princes continued to live in the Tower, but disappeared a couple of months later. They were the famous Princes in the Tower, thought by many to have been murdered on Richard III's instructions. Richard himself only reigned for 2 years before being killed at the Battle of Bosworth Field. His body was famously found under a car park in Leicester in 2012 and was reburied in Leicester Cathedral in 2015. On the 27th of June 2007, Tony Blair resigned as Prime Minister. He had come to power in the landslide Labour election victory of 1997. Aged 43, he was the youngest PM since Lord Liverpool in 1812. An early success was helping to negotiate the Good Friday Agreement in 1998, ending 30 years of conflict in Northern Ireland. He strongly supported the US administration of George W. Bush in its proposed invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, but he was later accused of misleading Parliament on the subject of weapons of mass destruction, and his popularity dropped dramatically. By early 2007, because of the Iraq War and low approval ratings, pressure built for him to go. On the 27th of June, he tendered his resignation, and Gordon Brown took over as Prime Minister and leader of the Labour Party the same day. On the 28th of June 1914, Archduke Franz Ferdinand, heir to the Austrian Empire, was assassinated in Sarajevo, Bosnia, by a young Serbian nationalist named Gavrilo Princip. Earlier in the day, the Archduke and his wife, Sophie, Duchess of Hohenberg, had survived when a would-be assassin threw a grenade at their car. They were unhurt, but members of their party in the car following were injured. Later, the royal couple wished to visit the injured in hospital. But on the way, their driver took a wrong turning and had to reverse. By astonishingly bad luck for the Archduke and his wife, Gavrilo Princip was sitting in a cafe on that very street. Scarcely believing his luck, he walked up to the royal car and shot them at point-blank range. Franz Ferdinand died within minutes, and Sophie on the way to hospital. As a result, the Austrian Empire declared war on Serbia, which escalated 2 months later into the First World War. On the 29th of June 1613, the original Globe Theatre in London was destroyed by fire. It had been built in 1599, partly using timbers from another theatre in Shoreditch, which had been dismantled after an ownership dispute. It was owned by shareholders of a players' company called the Lord Chamberlain's Men. They had the sole rights to produce plays by William Shakespeare, and many of his plays had their first performances there. It burnt down during a performance of Henry VIII, when a theatrical cannon set off during the performance misfired, igniting the wooden beams and thatching. According to one of the few surviving documents of the event, no one was hurt, except a man whose burning breeches were put out with a bottle of ale. It was rebuilt the following year, but was finally closed by the Puritans in 1642 and demolished in about 1644. On the 30th of June 1997, Hong Kong was handed back to China. Hong Kong Island had been ceded to Britain after the First Opium War in 1841, and was expanded when the Kowloon Peninsula was added after the Second Opium War in 1860. In 1898, a 99-year lease on the new territories was obtained. Under British rule, Hong Kong became a major trading port, and was one of the first industrial economies in Southeast Asia. Over time, it transitioned to a service economy, and by the 1990s it was a major global financial centre and shipping hub. As the end of the 99-year lease approached, Britain and China agreed the 1984 Joint Declaration, under which Britain would hand Hong Kong back to China, which in turn would guarantee its economic and political systems for 50 years. This triggered a wave of emigration, with over 500,000 people leaving between 1987 and 1996. There have been many protests over political reforms introduced in the years since the handover, most notably in 2019, when a proposed extradition bill caused demonstrations involving a claimed 3 million residents. On the 1st of July, 1867, the Dominion of Canada was formed when the previously separate provinces of New Brunswick, Nova Scotia and the Province of Canada, which consisted of what is now Ontario and Quebec, were amalgamated. This was only a small part of what is now Canada, with Prince Edward Island and the western provinces, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Alberta and British Columbia, joining over the next few decades. Interestingly, Newfoundland and Labrador remained under British rule until as late as 1949, when they were incorporated into Canada. Today, Canada is the world's second largest country by land area and has the world's 15th largest economy. And with that, we come to the end of this program. Many thanks to Deborah, Leslie, Wendy and Gabby, our readers today. To Rob, who wrote and read the radio highlights. To Robin and Richard, who make all the copies of the program and ensure you get yours. So that's all from Red Saturn for June 2022. Goodbye.